Mr. Jepson, reel two.
I was going to say that the net result of the question in the House of Commons about what I was doing eventually was answered by some authority saying that the matter was came under the heading or was governed or covered by necessities for national security. And there the matter ended.
Was this girl the only person who actually told you that she'd...
She was the only one who made a fuss because I wouldn't employ her. She seemed to be totally unsuitable.
Going back to the MI5, you said that you contacted them by phone. Did they telephone the result back to you or write to you?
Generally a telephone call. And I've forgotten the name of the chap I used to talk to. But he was au fait with what was going on. And I don't think on any single occasion did they suggest that I shouldn't use whoever's name I put forward. It was a very automatic thing. Nothing known against.
You said that you discovered that the Germans had got to know something about what you were doing. How did you discover
that? I only assumed it, because a certain number of people had been captured. And also, one had the top problem that in France, where my people were working, the collaborating aspect of French society made practically everything one did a bit insecure. And inevitably, the agents, secret agents, couldn't function without contacts with the French population, amongst whom would be the collaborators. And any one of them could have mentioned my name or talked about recruitment or his or her recruitment, not knowing that the person on the other side of the cafe table was a collaborator. See, the French tended all the time, as they always do, at a national habit and custom, to play both sides against the middle. They're individualists, and the tendency of an individual is to think about survival and his own safety rather more than most other people.
Now, when you interviewed someone to discover their suitability, can you tell me something about the interviews you conducted, how long they were?
The interview would never be the same. It would always the same. It would be a sort of conversation on various subjects leading up to the background of the potential recruit, what they did in civilian life, what their families were like, and whether they got on well with their husbands or their wives or whatever it might be. No two conversations could possibly be the same, because the backgrounds were never the same. But it was always a general conversation, so that in which it would be possible to get quite a lot about the person concerned. And I suppose as a writer, I got into the habit of observation of people and characters and temperaments and things like that. And I could generally, without a lot of trouble, get a conversation onto a sort of confessional basis as far as the person was concerned. And also, the fact that they were finding a sympathetic listener, in the same sense of, I suppose, that the priest meets in the confessional, somebody wants to get quite a lot of stuff off their shoulders. weight. In other words, the relief of being able to talk to a sympathetic stranger about their particular problems. And it's fairly easy to do that if you're interested in people and naturally a kindly disposition towards one's people who are not very happy.
Would you interview just by yourself, or would you have colleagues?
Oh, never, never, never anybody with me. That would inhibit any sort of confessional aspect. Wouldn't work at all. No, I interviewed entirely. It was a job which put me up by necessity on my own. And there was nobody to help me. Help of any kind, even of the best sort, would have been an inhibitory factor with which I did not wish to contend. I got enough troubles as it was.
So I presume from what you said that it was conducted on a purely informal rather than...
Entirely informal. The only time I put on uniform would be if I was interviewing somebody who was in the services. I never interviewed a civilian when in uniform. Never. I mean, this would automatically put us on a different level, a different personal level.
And presumably, did you sit one side of a desk and the other person on another side?
Yes, I had a desk, but there was nothing on it. And I think the desk, you see, the desk forms, and I discovered this instinctively perhaps, a desk form is a form of protection for the person who's being interviewed. There's a barrier, a physical barrier, between them and the examiner. So I always sat on one side, a very narrow desk, about the width of that table.
Just a couple of feet?
About 2 foot six, I suppose, something like that. I've got a desk in the other room, which was very like the one I had. And then I decided it was too formal, and I just threw out the desk and got an ordinary folding army-issue wooden table, which made it much easier. There was no sense of officialdom about it. The desk was a little bit official. I soon got rid of the desk. So it would be about that width, yes, 2 foot 6.
You've talked about the necessity for observing the person you are interviewing. What specifically were you looking out for?
Nothing specific. Just to get to know them as people, as quickly and as easily as possible. I was looking out for, yes, the basic qualities that would make for the sort of personal qualifications that one need, which would be the ability to function in difficult circumstances. And a great many people had it when put to it, and particularly during the war. The war was a great uplifter, because people then had a cause outside themselves. And since it comes under the heading of patriot, would be a very strong presentation of personality.
Would an agent have to be particularly intelligent?
Yes. The answer is intelligent, not particularly intelligent. Intelligent, in other words, able to function under the pressures of danger.
And presumably you were looking for someone with a calm rather than a nervous temperament.
Oh, yes. I think that anybody putting themselves in my position then would have had the same point of view. It's a natural human reaction to other human beings. There was nothing specialized about it. if you like, it was specialized in that I was experienced and knew a good deal about people and was very interested in people in an objective rather than a subjective way, as a writer generally is, unless he's got an axe to grind, which I guess is a bad writer, and I like to think that I was a good one.
You mentioned Odette with her powerful personality.
Yes.
You were looking for people with subdued, unobtrusive personality?
No, not subdued, no. Normal, natural. Because if you look for somebody with a subdued or retiring personality, you would have just as much trouble with them as if they had the opposite. One wanted normal, natural people with the qualifications and the courage and the motivation, and would not be looking over. I had to watch out for the domestic situation, of course, from which they came, in order that there should not be too much looking back over their shoulder. In other words, people who without strong family ties would be an advantage. Somebody who was wondering what was happening to their wife or their husband, whoever it might be, or their children. So they had to be individuals on their own and prepared to work on their own, or with whomsoever it was necessary to have an association in order to promote the work.
Were you on the lookout for people who might get into undesirable liaisons from the sexual point of view?
You couldn't look out for that, because inevitably they would get into sexual liaisons, not necessarily desirable. All one did was to see if they'd got level heads and would not let such a liaison interfere with their work. It would be the question of what sort of people were they. I mean, that aspect of life would have to be governed by their good sense.
What about the class background of the people you were recruiting?
The past background?
The class background.
That really comes to it. It would all be middle class, perhaps slightly upper middle class, because of the education which would have brought them into contact with France and French. I just say middle class. Lower middle class, in other words, your working class, as it's so called, or used to be called, wouldn't have the qualifications in terms of knowledge and language. They just wouldn't have it. If they had, and it did happen once or twice, I invented something called the coup de main recruit, which was the sort of person who couldn't pass very well for long, or very safely, because of limitations of education or whatever it might be, or again, who's French, who had all the qualifications except the French. The French had an English accent. That often happened. With those people, and it was always the men, I would put into a group which I call coup de main. And they went through the training, along with everybody else, but we used them operationally to go in and make their way out for one operation. So they didn't have to hang about and get and fall foul of the people looking for them. The observant people would notice something funny about them.
Were they all people who had lived some time in France?
Yes, inevitably, because otherwise, I mean, you mean the ones, the proper agents?
Yes.
Not the coup de main people. Oh yes, they had to be. They had to be. Inevitably.
And presumably some of them actually had French nationality.
One or two had dual nationality, but mostly what I tell you, there was one group that was always cropping up, and that were the sons and daughters of the First War soldiers who'd formed French liaisons or marriages. So they had a French father, I mean a British father, French mother. And they were very good because they had, if in the case of the women, whose first loyalty would be to the father, you know, in the normal psychological picture of a family, a British father and a French upbringing and a French mother was ideal, because the loyalty to the father meant loyalty to Britain. And that was, the question of loyalty was always at the bottom of it all, thinking and all questioning. Where is the loyalty? There was Inyat Khan. Her mother was an Indian princess, and her father was an Englishman. And when I got to the, she had perfect qualifications, amongst which was the fact that she was already in the British Army as an ATS and was a wireless telegraphist, which meant that she could then be a WT operator, ready-made. And when I got down to the question of loyalty, she said, my first loyalty is to India. And I said, right, I can understand that. She said, if I had to choose between Britain and India, I would choose India. I said, at the moment, we have to choose what you feel about the Germans. To which she said, I know the Germans, I don't want to see them lose this war. And I said, right, would you like to help them to that end? And that was the only time I met a loyalty that was not directly British.
That presumably was at a time when the Indian National Army had been formed in the Far East.
Oh yes, the rest of India was pro-British, but Indian nationalism was very strong at all times under the Raj. They never believed for a minute they were going to be like that forever.
Was loyalty to France a problem for you in recruiting?
Well, yes, loyalty to France was useful because it meant that they were against the Germans who were occupying their country. But on the whole, it was loyalty to Britain that I was looking for as the safest loyalty, because you couldn't. France being a divided nation, as it was then, and tends always to be in times of trouble, it wasn't safe to rely on loyalty to France.
But I was thinking about how later de Gaulle had a rather critical attitude towards some of the teams who were in France.
I think he had, because I spent my whole time keeping my people away from him. Because the Germans were putting double agents into small boats on the coast of France and pushing them towards England. They would then land and say they were refugees from France. And where was Monsieur de Gaulle? Where was the general? So, Free French. I invented an entire section called the French Liaison Section and put a whole full colonel in charge of it, who spent his whole time keeping the French, Free French, away from me. He became a member of Lieutenant Colonel Hutchison, without an N, Hutchison, who later became a Member of Parliament. Lovely little man. Understood perfectly what the job was. Hated the Free French.
Did he succeed in keeping them away from
him? Oh, yes, he kept them at bay. Yes, I had no trouble after that. I didn't really have any trouble at any time because nobody knew very much about me, you see, at the beginning, first year, perhaps, or first 8 or 9 months. It was then that it dawned on the French refugees and people like that that we were functioning in France in the resistance. It stood to reason that we would be doing that. It wasn't that as a policy, it wasn't something one should hide.
But before you, before the French liaison section was set up, had you been plagued with people approaching you?
No. Not really, no. They wouldn't, you see, the question of the source of a recruit was always basic to all preliminaries. If they came from the Free French, if somebody said, look, I know somebody in the Free French who might be useful, you know, I would steer clear. I'd just say, thank you very much, I'll make a note of his name. I didn't reject it out of hand because it would, you know, stop the source from functioning.
But did you ever have to accept people who you didn't really want to accept because of external pressures?
No. And if I did, well, now I suppose in a sense, now and again, somebody in the French section, we were only five of us. I mean, apart from the ancillary bodies, there were only five of us, and now and again, somebody might say they'd met somebody in a club or something, or, you know, they'd heard about somebody who might do. I'd never say, well, I don't think it would do. I'd always say, thank you very much. And they wouldn't really find, but they're too busy to find out what I'd done about it. But it would have been impolite, to say the least of it, to reject out of hand because clearly the background wasn't satisfactory.
Who were the five of you in the French section?
There was the Buckmaster, who was in charge of the section, Major Buckmaster then.
Right.
Then there was Patterson, who was in charge of intelligence and finance. There was André Morel, who came and went, sometimes went to France, but this was discouraged because he knew too much about our life at headquarters. There was a valuable lady who looked after the domestic aspect of their of people's lives. There was Coleman, who was in charge of weaponry and the packing and preparation of containers of weaponry for dropping in France. And somebody who was in, I've forgotten his name, who was in charge of transport in England. Yes, that's all I can remember.
What was Morel's job?
Morel's job was planning with the planners. I mean, there weren't any. The planners were Buckmaster and the rest of us. We'd have Tuesday meetings, planning operations, and Morel was on the operational side.
Did you say he was replaced later by someone else?
Then he, I've forgotten where he went. He went somewhere, but he wasn't replaced. By the time he went, the war was virtually coming to an end, and our organizations in France were functioning without any great help from us, except in terms of occasional needs for change of venue. I think that's about covers the headquarters staff.
Were personal relations good amongst the team?
Oh, excellent. And it, perhaps excellent because each one of us was responsible for a part and parcel of the work, not in general. There was nobody had a partner, even. We all functioned in our different departments on our own.
Was there much pressure of work?
A good deal of pressure of work, yes. I must say I got very tired towards the end. I didn't have a breakdown, but I decided I couldn't really go on with it. And by that time the work was done, so it was all right. But the pressure, you see, the thing that bothered me, I was too, of necessity, I had to be a sensitive. And being a sensitive, one became more and more aware of the function that one was performing, in effect, was a matter of deciding on the lives and deaths of men and women. It didn't suit me fundamentally. But at the same time, it made me completely objective. I daren't be subjective.
About how long would you spend on each person before you decided to recruit them? Was it a matter of days?
It would vary enormously. Sometimes I could do it after the preliminary interview. I might have up to 4 further interviews with that individual, or just the one. It would vary just as the people varied. You can't, and I'd never make any plan about how to handle. I'd play it all off the cuff as I went along. The only way to do it, because of the circumstances changed as you went along, as one's knowledge of the person increased, and their awareness of what the work would entail.
If you found that you were dubious about a person, if you couldn't really make your mind up, did you reject them or
at
was
once.
The...
Now, if I was dubious, and I wasn't often dubious, it meant they were... If I was dubious, they were wrong, by my counting. What made me dubious? It must have been some difference in them from the ones who were likely to prove...